Greetings, Earth Explorers. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains.
The spice is vital to space travel.
This is where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to find out more about who we are, why we are here, what we may become than you thought possible. Now, we might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear, you will be safely traveling with us. So recline your chair, look out the window, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. There is so much going on as we are in the final month of the 2012 saga. I don't know where to begin. I'm going to try to, over the next 3 weeks, land this airplane softly, because there's been so much hullabaloo, so much doom and gloom, so much end-of-the-world money being made on this whole 2012 thing. We wrote 4 books on the subject, and although I admit, historically speaking, there's a lot of doom and gloom in there, there's also hope. There's also a transition, an opening of human consciousness as it involves all of this end-of-the-world cataclysmic stuff. And we're glad you're here with us tonight, with me, my multiple personalities, as it were. The solar wind is a calm 308 kilometers per second, and there are 3 sunspot clusters on the sun today. Sunspot complex 1623 through 1625 have 4 dark cores that form a rectangle more than half a dozen Earths wide. The quartet has beta-gamma magnetic fields that harbor energy for M-class solar flares. Those are particularly nasty if they're large enough in magnitude. The only one higher is an X-class flare. Any eruptions this weekend would likely be geo-effective, as the sunspot group is turning to face Earth as we speak. Tonight, that's December 2nd through 3rd, Jupiter is at opposition, that is, directly opposite the Sun. So it rises at sunset and soars overhead at exactly midnight Eastern time, or your time. There is no better time to look at the giant planet, because this is the closest opposition of Jupiter until the year 2021. So if you have a good reflecting telescope, that's one with a mirror, or a refracting telescope, even better, because they have more magnification typically, you can look at Jupiter and really see some spectacular definition of Jupiter's storm. I have discussed the nature of banking in recent years. By the way, before I get into this, I forgot to tell you, our phone number is anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. If you're outside of that calling region, no problem. You can call 530-413-9537. Anywhere where you can find a cell phone tower, on planet or off planet, you can get to us, 530-413-9537. Or if you're using Skype, which many people do to kind of keep the cell phone and long-distance charges down, you can reach us simply at BBS Radio 2, the number 2, BBS Radio 2. Or if you're planning on slipping out and doing a little Christmas shopping tonight, you can listen to us by cell phone. There are 2 ways you can do this. One is to dial 805-399-1000 and then hit the passcode 769-608-pound, 769-608-pound. Or you can simply go to x2-radio.com. That's our website for X Squared Radio. And you can click on the Droid app. So if you have a non Apple phone, you can click on the Droid app, download it to your phone, and all you have to do is hit that, and boom, you're right into Channel 2 at BBS Radio. As you are selecting your Christmas presents this year, I want you to keep one thing in mind. Nothing says I love you like food. Well, I like apple pie too, but I mean food for survival. And there are a lot of companies out there that sell stuff, all kinds of sterilized non-nutritive cellulose with food flavorings. Or you can buy those pasty MREs. They're heavy to pack around. Or you can go to X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com. Right there at the top on the right-hand side is the affiliates bar. And you can invest in food by going to our favorite affiliate, the Food Investor. Everything is packaged for you. It'll last for 30 years, so you don't have to maintain it at all. You just buy it, put it in a backpack, set it aside, and you're good to go. 72-hour kits for 1, 2, 4, 6 people, all prepackaged for you on the website. And the food is delicious because it's prepared by my good friends out in Utah, Danny and Scott, and no preservatives. It's good for you. It's delicious tasting. It's the only one of its kind, lightweight, foil-packed, ready to go, and affordable. X2-radio.com, Food Investor. Buy that instead of those expensive electronic toys for your kids or grandkids. And then if a New Jersey or a Louisiana or a South Los Angeles happens to them, because they're getting pounded by the atmospheric river right now. We'll explain that a little bit more tonight. If they have to skedaddle, get out of their house for a few days, they have all the food that they need, and they even have a water filter. So you don't become a burden on FEMA, like FEMA's going to take care of you, make sure you have cookies and cocoa and a warm blanket, maybe the size of a pillowcase if you're lucky. Now you can take care of yourself, and you don't have to worry about the government taking care of you and yours. So give that. Invest in food at the Food Investor. Now, the reason I want to discuss this tonight is because a lot of you have written me and asked me about the Federal Reserve. You have read my book, Alienated Nation. You wonder why I don't have some chapters in there excoriating the Federal Reserve. It's because the story is so big that it could be a book by itself. And that wasn't the purpose of the book. The purpose of the book was to open your eyes to the idea that states can initiate and complete a constitutional convention to fix this republic and the problems that we are having as the executive branch is trying to seize control of the republic. Oh, they are still happening. It's the biggest coup since, I don't know, in the United States. I don't think it's ever happened before, but we're undergoing it as we speak, and you are seeing the brazen activities of executives gone wild as the executive branch is now feeling its mandated oats and bludgeoning Congress and thus the American people with its ideas about how the nation should be run of the executive branch by the executive branch and for the executive branch. I have discussed the nature of banking in recent years from a scientific and mathematical point of view. And I have cited that they have been nefarious at best. The main reason for the Revolutionary War after our Declaration of Independence, you remember that from school, don't you? If you went to a government school, you may have recalled that somewhere in history. The main reason for the Revolutionary War was to end the power of the central bank. And not so much against any one ideology. It wasn't that we hated monarchies. It wasn't that we were against English accents or red uniforms. None of that. None of that. It didn't have anything to do with religion either. It had to do with the power of the central bank over business and commerce. The aversion of the founding fathers to a central bank was a cornerstone of the colonial government. It did follow us to America. We did debate it fervently. Hamilton wanted a central bank. Jefferson, Franklin, all talked about the weaknesses that occur relative to the people, to those that control money, control the value of money, the supply of money. And so a central bank was written specifically in the Constitution to not be allowed in the United States of America. The plan, however, by the private banks ever since, and I'm talking about since 1785, the plan by the private banks ever since has been to recapture the global market, which would include the upstart colonial America. Now, it took a while. It took a while because not only did you have to have the power of the central banks, but you had to have the control over the currency and you had to have control over the law. Rumored for decades has been the plan to do away with the U.S. dollar. Come on, we can go back to the 70s and get articles about how the U.S. dollar was going to go away and, you know, we were going to have some kind of North American currency. Well, in a recent article, the plan to phase out the paper dollar has regained new life. You'll remember that I said it would be supported by the American voter. After all, 48% of them have no paper dollars to speak of, as a move in the right direction, since only rich people have money anyway. We are definitely in a condition in this country, and we're not alone, where the rich are the enemy, and government is going to fight, and I quote, fight in Washington for your rights, you middle class and below middle class. To some of that money, even though you didn't work for it, even though you didn't invest it, even though you didn't inherit it, even though you didn't earn it, government is going to fight for your right to some of that money. And 48% of America has spoken. I mean, that's what they want to do. So here's the article, the end of the dollar bill. Not the American dollar, but the dollar bill, the paper money. American consumers have shown about as much appetite for the $1 coin as kids do to their spinach. They may not know what's best for them either. Congressional auditors say doing away with dollar bills, paper money, entirely, and replacing them with dollar coins could save taxpayers some $4.4 billion over the next 30 years. Vending machine operators have long championed the use of dollar coins because they don't jam the machines, cutting down on repair costs and lost sales. Coins don't wear out. If you put them in the laundry, the dog doesn't eat them and hurt them. You know, we have to replace paper money as it goes through the banking system every single day. But most people don't like to carry the coins. In the past 5 years, the U.S. Mint has produced 2.4 billion presidential $1 coins. Most are stored by the Federal Reserve, unissued, and production was suspended about a year ago. It couldn't have anything to do with the fact that it was darn close to the size of a quarter, and people just couldn't tell. And it couldn't be because it's very difficult to fold up, you know, a bankroll of $1 bills and look like you have a lot of money if they're coins. It just doesn't fit well in the pocket. Jingle, jingle, you know what I mean. The latest projection from the Government Accountability Office, that's the GAO for many of you that hear that acronym on the news, on the potential savings from switching to dollar coins entirely comes as lawmakers begin exploring new ways for the government to save money by changing the money itself. The Mint is preparing a report for Congress showing how changes in the metal content of coins could save money. And we're talking about moves away from expensive metals like copper and, of course, gold and nickel. The last time the government made major metallurgical changes, in U.S. coins was nearly 50 years ago when Congress directed the Mint to remove silver from dimes and quarters and to reduce its content in half-dollar coins. Now Congress is looking at new change. By the way, they went to zinc for pennies as well. Now Congress is looking at new changes in response to rising prices of copper and nickel. At a House subcommittee hearing Thursday, the focus was on two approaches. The first, moving to less expensive combinations of metal like steel, aluminum, and zinc. And the second is gradually taking dollar bills out of the economy and replacing them with coins. Now, I will tell you, in my opinion, this is a move to make people get in the habit of not carrying cash on them. In fact, not dealing with cash at all. Cash, we equate to paper. When we say, you know, $20 in cash, we mean either $20 bills or, you know, two fives and a 10 or two tens or a 20. We talk about cash. We don't talk about 21 dollar coins or, you know, a combination thereof. Gradually taking dollar bills out of the economy and replacing them with coins is a move to get people to rely more on plastic ones and zeros in their account using debit cards everywhere instead of carrying cash on them. Now, I'm not saying that they would do away with fives, tens, and 20s, and 50s, and hundreds, but let's face it. I mean, the dollar bill has become worth about 17 cents. To buy anything, even a tank full of gas, takes, you know, a shirt pocket full of $1 bills. The dollar, the one, has become worth so little that who carries it anymore unless to make exact change? The GAO's Lorelei St. James told the House Financial Services panel it would take several years for the benefits of switching from paper bills to dollar coins to catch up with the cost of making the change. Equipment would have to be bought or overhauled, and more coins would have to be produced up front to replace bills as they are taken out of circulation. But over the years, the savings would begin to accrue, she said, largely because a $1 coin would stay in circulation for 30 years, well, unless it's lost somehow, while paper bills have to be replaced every 4 or 5 years on average, and I would say earlier than that for ones, because ones get, I think, a lot more circulation than the other bills do. I mean, when is the last time you really held a crisp new $1 bill in your hands? Eh? Yeah. New 20s, yeah. New 5s, of course. Hundreds, face it, as crispy as can be. Fresh off the mint. Ones, I've seen some rough ones. Dragged down the highway $1 bills, and so have you. Quote, we continue to believe that by replacing the note with a coin is likely to provide a financial benefit to the government, said St. James, who added that such a change would work only if the note was completely eliminated and the public educated about the benefits of the switch. Even the $1 coin's most ardent supporters recognize that they have not been popular. Philip Deal, former director of the Mint, said there was a huge demand for the Sacagawea dollar coin when production began in 2001, but as time wore on, people stayed with what they knew best. We've never bitten the bullet to remove the $1 bill, as every other Western economy has done, Deal said. If you did, it would have the same success the Canadians have had. Beverly Lepine, chief operating officer of the Royal Canadian Mint, said her country loves its loonie, the nickname for the $1 coin that includes an image of a loon on the back. The switch went over so well that the country also went to a $2 coin called the Toonie. Representative Bill Huizenga, Republican from Michigan, affirmed that Canadians have embraced their dollar coins. I don't know anyone who would go back to the $1 and $2 bills, he said. That sentiment was not shared by some of his fellow subcommittee members when it comes to the U.S. version. Representative Lacey Clay, Democrat from Missouri, said men don't like carrying a bunch of coins around in their pocket or in their suits. I mean, come on, it just means more if you can take out a wad of cash. than a double handful of coins. And Representative Carolyn Maloney, Democrat from New York, said the $1 coins have proved too hard to distinguish, as I said earlier, from quarters. If the people don't want it and they don't want to use it, she said, why in the world are we even talking about changing it? It's really a matter of getting used to it, said Deal, the former Mint director. Several lawmakers were more intrigued with the idea of using different metal combinations in producing coins. Representative Steve Stivers, Republican from Ohio, said a penny costs more than 2 cents to make and a nickel costs more than 11 cents to make. Moving to multi-plated steel for coins would save the government nearly $200 million a year, he said. The Mint's report, which is due in mid-December, will detail the results of nearly 18 months of work exploring a variety of new metal compositions and evaluating test coins for attributes as hardness, resistance to wear, availability of raw materials and costs. And by the way, I would add that no coins can be picked up with a magnet. But if they go to steel, a magnet could definitely pick up money. Just something to think about when you're, doing metal detecting on the beach. Richard Peterson, the Mint's acting director, declined to give lawmakers a summary of what will be in the report, but he said several promising alternatives were found. The U.S. Mint, however, no longer has control over the right to mint dollars. That was once a congressional responsibility that was abdicated to private firms known as the Federal Reserve. Now, as I said earlier, lots of people have written me and asked me how that happened in the first place. And, of course, what can be done about it. Many, many, many Ron Paul supporters have written me, have emailed me, have called me, and said, what the heck is going on? Why is Ron Paul being excoriated for wanting to get rid of the Federal Reserve? What's going on there? Why can't we do it? What is the obstacle, and is the Federal Reserve so powerful that no lawmaker would dare go up against them? So I am about to tell you the story of how, in the dark of night, like wizards conjuring up demons from the underworld, our own Congress conspired with organized criminals to usurp America's ownership over its own currency. Franklin and Jefferson be damned. Hamilton's behind-the-scenes money lenders were about to take control of the world again. Back in 1910, remember that the American economy, hang on a second while I have a sip of my lovely grapefruit juice. Well, that's so good I had to have a gulp. Oh, yeah. The Roaring Twenties were about to take place. One of the things that people don't realize, or maybe they do realize, is when the money supply is available, that is to say, the average entrepreneur, the average farmer, the average small businessman has access to capital, they like to expand. They like to grow. They like to speculate. They like to invest. Investors like to invest, and they love to see growth. It's just exciting. That's one of the things people love to do when they have a lot of money, is watch the money work for them. They don't want to sit there and stare at it. They want it to grow. They want it to do stuff normally. Now, sometimes they invest it in the bank when the bank is paying good rates. They don't want to take a risk. They figure the bank is not a risk. They put it in CDs or notes or bonds or whatever, some kind of bill. But playing the stock market is particularly exhilarating when you can invest in a company at 10 cents and it goes to $10. That's really what makes America amazing, is that people can make smart investments and own a little upstart online bank called PayPal, and the next thing you know, they own a giant electric car company and shooting off rockets into space. That's just what America's all about. So back in 1910, there was you know, quite a bit of money around. We were getting ready to go into World War One. World War One was the war to end all wars. And when it was over, and the boys came home, and the industrialists saw that there was great opportunity in the industrial engines of the world, not the least of which was in Germany, but also here in the U.S. It was time to invest, and it was time to reap big rewards, which meant the money supply was about to increase big time. There was a small group of men that didn't want that to happen unless they were involved in the money supply. So in 1910, Jekyll Island, just the perfect name for what was about to happen, was completely privately owned, the whole island and all the buildings on it, by a small group of millionaires from New York. Now, we're talking about such people as J.P. Morgan. You know who that is, right? J.P. Morgan Stanley, that bank, run now by I'm going to call him charismatic, but he's also very brilliant, and he's also publicly very pleasing to the eye. He has an easy manner. He dresses well. He communicates well. And by all intents and purposes, maybe the most powerful banker in the world, individually speaking. Another man, William Rockefeller, and, of course, their associates. This was a social club, and it was called the Jekyll Island Club. They owned the island, and it was where their families came to spend their winter months. And these were probably the wealthiest, most powerful financial people in the Western world. When they go on vacation, they don't want people coming up to them asking them for money. They don't want people asking for autographs or pitching deals to them. They want to go someplace where they can let their hair down, lay on the beach, with or without, and not have to worry about paparazzi or anybody like that. And so they own the bloody island and all the access to it. There was a magnificent structure there, the clubhouse, which was the center of their social activities. That clubhouse is still there, by the way, and in pretty good condition. The island has since been purchased by the state of Georgia. It's been converted into a state park, and the clubhouse has been restored, so you can visit it if you want. If you're a medium, maybe you can go and see if the walls will speak to you. I think you'd be very impressed by it anyway. If you make your way down there, you should go visit it. As you walk through the downstairs corridors, you'll come to a door, and on the door there's a brass plaque, and it says, "In this room, the Federal Reserve System was created." Now, this is not a secret anymore. It's a matter of public record. Around the clubhouse, there were some cottages, as they were called, which were built by some of the families to quarter themselves. They're attractive little things. They were magnificent examples of the architecture of the turn of the century. One of the cottages through which they take tours, if you're interested in doing that, as I recall the guide told us when we were there, 14 bathrooms in that cottage. Now, that's not what you and I would call a cottage, but this is basically a winter home for somebody just wanting to go play for a while and don't want to use the restroom in the same room twice for a couple of weeks. The clubhouse is where the Federal Reserve System was created. So let's retell that story in detail and see how it came out. The year was 1910. That was 3 years before the Federal Reserve Act was finally passed into law. It was November of that year when Senator Nelson Aldrich sent his private railroad car to the railroad station in New Jersey, and there it was in readiness for the arrival of himself and six other men who were to come under the conditions of great secrecy. For example, they were told to arrive one at a time and not to dine with each other on the night of their departure. They were told that they should arrive at the station at the same time. They should pretend like they didn't even know each other. They were instructed to avoid newspaper reporters at all cost because they were well-known people, and had they been seen by a reporter, they would have asked questions, especially if two or three of them had been spotted together. This would have really raised eyebrows, and they would have asked a lot of questions. One of the men carried a shotgun in a big black case. so that if he had been stopped and asked where he was going, he was prepared to say that he was going on a duck hunting trip. The interesting thing about that part of the story is that we found out later that from his biographer, that this man never fired a gun in his entire life. In fact, he borrowed that shotgun just to carry with him on this trip as part of the deception. Once they got aboard the private railroad car, this pattern continued. They were told to use first names only, not to use their last names at all. A couple of the men even adopted code names, you know, like Mr. White and Mr. Pink and Mr. Black. The reason for this is so that the servants on board the train would not know who these people were. They were afraid that if the servants would talk about it, then the word would leak out and it might get into the press. Remember, they were on a 3-year mission that they were just starting that day. They traveled for 2 nights and a day aboard this car, and they arrived after a 1,000-mile journey to Brunswick, Georgia. From there, they took a ferry across the Inlet Straits, and they ended up on Jekyll Island in the clubhouse, where for the next 9 days, they sat around the table and hammered out all the important details of what eventually became the Federal Reserve System. When they were done, they went back to New York. Now, I will tell you that there was no representative of the American people in this room. This was a design to create a money system, a banking system to be able to control the money system, and a backdoor access to that banking system that controlled the money system to only a very few men. For quite a few years thereafter, these men denied that any such meeting took place. It wasn't until after the Federal Reserve System was firmly established that they then began to talk openly about their journey and what they accomplished. Several of them wrote books on the topic. One of them wrote a magazine article, and they gave interviews to newspaper reporters. So now it's possible to go into the public record and document quite clearly and in detail what happened there. Now, who were these seven men? The first one, I've already mentioned, Senator Nelson Aldrich, was the Republican whip in the Senate. He was the chairman of the National Monetary Commission, which was the special committee of Congress, created for the purpose of making a recommendation to Congress for proposed legislation to reform banking. The public was quite concerned in those days over what was going on in the banking industry. Sound familiar? A lot of banks were folding, going under. People were losing their investments in banks. They had broken their promise to guard the depositors' assets. And there were runs on the bank. Banks couldn't give the money to their people because, well, they had spent it. They'd invested it, just like they do today. If there was a run on the bank today, the bank would be in exactly the same position as before. That's the whole reason the FDIC is in place. It's an insurance policy that insures deposits up to $100,000. I think it may be $200,000 now. But you got to read the small print of that little policy, because there are two things about it I bet you don't know. The first is, only the principal of your money is covered, and only if your account is not involved in the money market, which means if you have a checking account and you're avoiding those checking account fees each month by letting your money be used by the bank on the money market in the evenings, your money is not covered under the FDIC. The second is, if there is a default at the bank closes, there's a run on the bank, and everybody runs and tries to get their money, the bank has up to 10 years to return the principal of your money to you. It's true. Now, in particular, they were concerned over the concentration of wealth in the hands of a few large banks in New York on Wall Street. Keep in mind, that was in 1910. We're now in 2012. Over 100 years later, we still have exactly the same worries. All of the wealth is concentrated in the hands of a few large banks in New York on Wall Street. This is what they called the money trust in those days. The money trust was a common phrase. Quite a few politicians had been elected to office on their campaign promise to break the grip of the money trust. Sound familiar? President Woodrow Wilson was one of those politicians that campaigned on that, even though Wilson himself was hand-picked by the money trust and financed by the money trust and surrounded by the money trust. All of his advisors and political cronies were members of the money trust, i.e., Wall Street. The public didn't know that at the time, and it was a popular issue. If you campaigned against the money trust, you were quite apt to be elected. And that is what we call the people you love to hate money trust. You know, those nefarious Wall Street brokers. Why, they just control everything. And so if a young man were to go out and say how bad Wall Street was and how terrible it is, and what was it they said? Unchain Wall Street. Are they going to put you all back in chains? Well, I can tell you right now, this is my own personal opinion, the only chain that has been within 20 blocks of Wall Street the last 48 months has been made of gold. There has not been one single solitary prosecution by the SEC for any kind of banking improprieties. And keep in mind, from 2009 to 2011, the biggest bank heist in the history of the world took place, and there were zero prosecutions. So today we have the people you love to hate, Wall Street. Occupy Wall Street. We have a very public mistrust of Wall Street. When small business is introduced to lending sources or investment sources or venture capital sources, and the opening line is, this guy's good because he's a former Wall Street broker. He spent 20 years on Wall Street. Anytime you hear that, immediately button the top button to your suit, stand up, and walk out. All right. That was one of the purposes of the National Monetary Commission. Those of you that remember your history know what that was all about. It was to propose legislation to break the grip of the money trust. And Aldrich was chairman of that committee. He was like the Elliot Ness of banking. He was also the very important business associate of none other than J.P. Morgan. He was the father-in-law of John D. Rockefeller Jr., which means that eventually he became the grandfather of Nelson Rockefeller, our former vice president. You remember, his full name was Nelson Aldrich Rockefeller, his middle name being derived from his famous grandfather. The second important person there was Abraham Andrew, who was also Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. He later became a congressman, and he was very important in banking circles. The other man was Frank Vanderlip. I don't know if you remember him, but he was the president of the National City Bank of New York, which was the largest of all the banks in America, representing the financial interests of William Rockefeller and the international investment firm of Kuhn, Loeb and Company. Henry Davidson was also there, the senior partner of the J.P. Morgan Company. Charles Norton was there. He was the president of the First National Bank of New York, which was another one of the giants. Benjamin Strong was at the meeting. He was the head of J.P. Morgan's Bankers Trust Company, and Benjamin Strong, 3 years later, would become the first head of the Federal Reserve System. You get the picture here? It's a tight little family of friends. Finally, there was Paul Warburg, a very important name, who was probably the most important at the meeting because of his knowledge of banking as it was practiced in Europe. Paul Warburg was born in Germany and eventually became a naturalized American citizen. He was a partner in Kuhn, Loeb & Company and was a representative of the Rothschild banking dynasty in England and France, where he maintained very close working relationships throughout his entire career with his brother, Max Warburg, who was the head of the Warburg Banking Consortium in Germany and the Netherlands. Now, is the picture getting a little more clear to you? Well, the public knew about this too. And, you know, oftentimes the public is exposed to this through movies and through satires. You remember a little book called The Wizard of Oz, right? All of that's a political satire by Frank L. Baum about the proletariat movement with William Cullen Bryant, blah, blah, blah. Well, Paul Warburg was one of the wealthiest men in the entire world. In fact, those of you who are a little who remember Little Orphan Annie will remember Daddy Warbucks. Yes, Daddy Warbucks was the characterization of Paul Warburg. And everyone at that time was well aware of that fact. If you compare the photograph of Paul Warburg to Daddy Warbucks to the cartoon drawing, you'll see the resemblance. It's perfect. And while we're on the top of cartoon characters, if you played Monopoly, you remember the drawing of the capitalist, you know, with the handlebar mustache and a cigar? Well, that's J.P. Morgan. These were the seven men aboard that rail car who were at Jekyll Island. Amazing as it may seem, they represented approximately a quarter of the wealth of the entire world. Get it? These seven guys owned 25% of the wealth of the world. These are the men that sat around the table and created the Federal Reserve System. For the skeptic who's wondering, it didn't happen that way. Surely Griffin is exaggerating. Dr. Agnew's making this all up to make some kind of point. Let me put your mind at ease that it did happen that way exactly. How do we know? For example, Frank Vanderlip, who was at the meeting, wrote an article that appeared in a Saturday Evening Post on February 9th, 1935. We'll just quote it a little bit. This is what Vanderlip said, quote, "I do not feel it is any exaggeration to speak of our secret expedition to Jekyll Island as the occasion of the actual conception of what eventually became the Federal Reserve System. We were told to leave our last names behind us. We were told further that we should avoid dining together on the night of our departure. We were instructed to come one at a time and at unobtrusive and be as unobtrusive as possible to the railroad terminal on the New Jersey littoral of the Hudson, where Senator Aldrich's private car would be in readiness attached to the rear end of a train to the south. Once aboard the private car, we began to observe the taboo that had been fixed on last names. We addressed one another as Ben, Paul, Nelson, Abe. Davidson and I adopted even deeper disguises, abandoning our first names, on the theory that we were always right. He became Wilbur, and I became Orville, after those two aviation pioneers, the Wright brothers. The servants and train crew may have known the identities of one or two of us, but they did not know all, and it was the names of all printed together that would have made our mysterious journey significant in Washington and Wall Street, even in London. Discovery, we knew, simply must not happen." Close quote. Why not? Why the secrecy? What's the big deal about a group of bankers getting together in private and talking about banking or even banking legislation? And the answer is provided by Vanderlip himself in the same article, 1935. He said, and I quote, "If it were to be exposed publicly that our particular group had gotten together and written a banking bill, that bill would have no chance whatever of passage by Congress," close quote. Why not? How come? Because the purpose of the bill was to break the grip of the money trust, and it was written by the money trust. You see the conflict of interest? I can tell you which interest went out. And had that fact been known at the get-go, we would never have had a Federal Reserve System, because as Vanderlip said, it would have had no chance of passage at all by Congress. They would have figured it out. So it was essential to keep that whole thing a secret, as it has remained a secret even to this day. Well, not exactly a secret, because we're talking about it tonight on X Squared Radio. We don't know any of this in the official literature from the Federal Reserve System, because that was like asking the fox to build the hen house and, of course, install the security system. That was the reason for the secrecy at the meeting, because they were going to design a back door, a way to be able to pull the puppet strings and make the money system do not what should happen, what they wanted to happen. Now, we know something very important about the Federal Reserve System that we didn't know before, but there's much more to it than that. Consider the composition of this group. Here we had the Morgans, the Rockefellers, Kuhn, Loeb Company, the Rothschilds, and the Warburgs. I mean, is there anything strange about that mixture? Think about it for a second. These guys didn't work together. They were competitors. Yes, between them they controlled a quarter of the wealth of the world. But they didn't share the wealth of the world. These were the major competitors in the field of investment and banking in those days. These were the giants. Prior to this period, they were beating their heads against each other. It was a banking war, blood all over the battlefield, fighting for dominance in the financial markets of the world. These were the industrialists, and they knew war was coming. They knew it years before it was going to happen. Not only in New York, but London, Paris, everywhere. And here they are, sitting around a table with cigars and scotch, coming to an agreement of some kind. What's going on here? What is going on? We need to ask a few questions. Why would people, whose people, whose organizations are at war with each other, by phone, by telegraph, they're beating each other to the investments, they're competing against one another for the availability and application of capital. This is extremely significant, because it happened precisely at that point of in American history where business was undergoing a major and fundamental change in ideology. Prior to this point, American business had been operating under the principles of private enterprise. You know what we're talking about. Free enterprise. Competition is what made America great, right? Because when companies compete against one another, it's all about the value proposition, right? It's who makes the best car, not the cheapest car. Best is in the eye of the purchaser. Yes, it has to do with power, and it has to do with looks and reliability, but also price and also service. You know, what does the car do? How long will it last? What's its trade-in value? How much does it cost to insure? These are all part of the value proposition for us. So best is fleshed out in the process of competition. What caused it to surpass all the other nations in the world? It's that. It's that free enterprise was the Wild West in the United States. There was no monopoly. There was no one company that said, you will buy it and you will like it. No. It was you had the choice, and may the best man win. And so brains were pitted against brains, and the consumer was the winner. Well, once we had achieved that pinnacle of performance, however, this was the point in history where the shift was going away from competition toward monopoly. This has been described in many textbooks as the drawing of the era of the cartoon. cartel. Have you heard that word lately? The cartel. And this is exactly what was happening in 1910. For the 15-year period prior to this meeting, going all the way back to 1890, the very investment groups about which we are speaking were coming together more and more and engaging in joint ventures rather than competing with each other. The meeting on Jekyll Island was merely the culmination of that trend where they came together completely and decided not to compete. They formed a cartel, a financial cartel. A little bit of grapefruit juice before I continue. Now here we are 100 years later, and that cartel has not been taken apart. In fact, it's been fortified. In fact, the agencies that have been created starting in 1932 and going for 80 years to 2012 have slowly, meticulously, one court case at a time, carefully, by design, as though an engineering plan laying the foundation and then the floor and then the walls and then the roof and then all of the trim and utilities, been building a house as solid as stone of regulations that have the force of law to not only protect the cartel, but to increase its ability to seize control of currency. Now, first I need to define that word so you'll know what I mean when I use the word cartel. It's kind of trashed in the press, and we lose perspective when that happens. It's a group of independently owned businesses which come together for the purpose of reducing or eliminating competition between themselves. That's why we talk about drug cartels. They don't want to shoot at each other in the streets. No, they carve up the market, and they say, this is your territory, and this is your territory, and we work together. We take on the risk together, fighting governments and fighting the monetary systems, that is to say, moving illegal cash back to the growers and the owners of the cartel. We build the cartel so that we do not compete against one another. They do this by various means, one of which is by price fixing, no competition on price. There are other means, collusion. If we were forming a cartel here, I might insist that I get the North and you have the South and we don't compete. Or I would say I'll produce the gizmo and you can have the widget and we won't compete. Or we'll share patents and processes, and whatever we do, we agree to eliminate competition between ourselves. We squeeze everyone out except us. No small business can compete against us. No patents can be filed or accepted in this area. No financing will be granted to this company or that company because they may compete with us. The more layers of agreement that we put one on top of the other, the more we become encased in this cartel structure. And we become as one insofar as the market is concerned, even though within that grouping, technically, we are separately owned. This is just as true with the banking cartel as it is with any other industry, automotive, drugs, food. We come to the conclusion that we analyze the nature of the Federal Reserve System, how it operates, read the Federal Reserve Act, place it against the context of the historical background, and we come smack to the realization that the Federal Reserve System, although it parades around looking as though it's a government operation of some kind, it's merely a cartel of banks right under our noses, and it's protected by law. Now, conclusion number two about the Federal Reserve System. A very important thing that we don't know, that we didn't know, is the cartel. Even more to it than that. Perhaps the third ingredient is the most important of all, and that is the realization that this cartel went into partnership, well, not with criminals. They went into partnership with government. Remember the senator's train? Now we have hold of something extremely significant. Cartels often go into partnership with governments because they need the force of law to enforce their cartel agreement. But in this case, They did it in spades. Oh, and it was crafty. I want you to understand this. I'm going to run a little bit long this hour because I want you to understand this. Now, listen, let me think about it. I think in order for you to understand it clearly, I think first we need to take a break. Let me see here. What shall I run? I know what I'm going to do. This will fit right in. I'm going to play Muse, Uprising. Let's take a quick break. Be right back with more X Squared Radio. Don't go away because, you talk about conspiracy theories. This is it in spades, and you're going to love it how this unfolds. Here we go. Well, I thought I was going to go there. Here we go. We'll be right back. welcome back to X Squared Radio's second hour, December 2nd, 2012. Thank you for joining us tonight. By the way, if you want to be part of the program, you've got an insight or a feeling about the Federal Reserve that Mike 8429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can reach the cell phone, you can get to us 530-413-9537. Or if you're using Skype, you can reach us at simply BBS Radio 2, the number 2, BBS Radio 2. Don't forget, if you're just joining us, getting ready to go out and do some Christmas shopping this week, we think here at X Squared Radio, the best gift that you can give your loved ones, given the events that we have seen in the past couple of years, is the safety of food. So if you're going to invest in something you know is going to hold its value, that is to say, maybe save your life, invest in food. Just go to X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com. Click on the Food Investor in the upper right-hand corner, special packages just for X Squared Radio listeners. My good friends Scott and Danny out in Utah have made a food that will last for 30 years. It's a set-it-and-forget-it kind of food. No preservatives, delicious stuff, and it's a little less expensive than that pasty MRE stuff that you can buy, surplus stuff. This is brand spanking new, made-to-order. So check it out. We're talking about continued conversation, or at least a dissertation that I'm making about the Federal Reserve. Some of this, of course, is taken from text that has already been prepared. Most of it's, you know, my opinion, of course, and you can take it for what it's worth. But a lot of people have asked the questions about the Federal Reserve, whether it's federal, whether there's anything in reserve. And I'm sure if you're a Ron Paul follower or loyal voter, you already know most of this. But you don't know how the Federal Reserve was formed. You don't know why it was formed, why it's still in power, who controls it, and really how powerful it has become. We were at the close of the last hour talking about the partnership that the cartel has formed with government. Now, when we think of cartel, we think of something illegal, and this most certainly is illegal activity. Monopolies in the United States of America are illegal. Monopolies in any part of the world are, immoral. And they violate the very fiber of humanity, these unalienable rights that are given to us by God. They step on them. They remove the competition between businesses that tends to bring the best services and the best support to the consumer, because ultimately it is our buying power. It is our choices. It is our labor turned into money that is the driving force of all economies everywhere in the world. When something stands in between the integrity of that work, that conversion into value, and being able to get what we pay for, then it becomes an immoral imperative against free enterprise. And I maintain on this program that it is free enterprise that brings the very best to market. It allows us to get the best technology. Otherwise, we would still be driving around horse and buggies, and the buggy whip companies would have been preserved forever. When a partnership is formed, there has to be benefit to the partners. Otherwise, they don't form it, right? I mean, if you make an agreement with somebody and they get all the good stuff and you get all the bad stuff, how long is that agreement going to last? Well, it'll last as long as you're willing to take it, right? And when you're done taking it, then you're going to breach the contract. Labor does it. Employees do it. Managers do it. And companies do it with one another. When they've had enough, they say, that's it. I'm not going to do it anymore. Well, for a little over 100 years, from 1910 until 2012, 102 years, these partners have been perfectly happy with their relationship. So how did they do it? How did banking and government make this partnership? How did both sides benefit from it? We hear so much bashing in the press back and forth, how evil Wall Street is and how chained, unchained they are, and they put us back in chains. And you can't even keep up with the rhetoric anymore. So we need to ask the question, what's the benefit? What's the payoff for these two giant partners? Why did they go into it? Why did the government go into a partnership like this? And why does the banking cartel allow it? In answering those questions, we finally come to grips with the reality of what this creature from Jekyll Island really is. Let's take a look at that. What's the payoff to these two partners? In order to see that, we'll have to examine in some detail the mechanism by which the Federal Reserve creates money. Now, remember, it's Congress, according to the Constitution, that has the authority and the responsibility to mint, print money. This is a real interesting study. It can be called the Mandrake Mechanism, named after the comic book character of the 1940s. Mandrake the Magician, who could create something out of nothing and then wave his cape and it was back into the void again. That's a pretty descriptive phrase for the way the Federal Reserve System does it. Let's take a look at it, see how they create money through this Mandrake Mechanism. It's a simplified form, but I want to warn you, it's going to sound like it's too simple. Believe me, it is not. I'm going to strip out all the banking terminology, all the banker language, all the accounting phrases that need to be defined, and I'm going to speak in just regular old plain English that anybody can understand. It may sound to you as though I've simplified it too much, but I want to assure you that in spite of the simple language, everything I'm going to tell you is absolutely 100% technically accurate. The other thing I want to warn you about is don't try and make sense out of this because it cannot be done. Remember, it's magic. This does not make sense, and you'll blow a fuse if you try to make it make sense. Just remember, it is a scam, and if you keep that fact in your mind, then you'll always have no trouble comprehending what's going on. If you have any questions, you can, of course, call me, 888-429-5471, and we'll discuss it. Okay, here's how it works. This is the science of it, okay? We're approaching this from a scientific and mathematical point of view. Not too much, so I don't lose many of you, but this is the way it works. Now, it starts with the government side of the partnership. It starts in Congress, which is spending money like crazy. You know what it's like, right? Somebody hands you a checkbook with, let's say, 1,000 checks in it, and they say, you know what? Don't worry about the balance. Don't worry about it. Go on a shopping spree. Buy whatever you want from whomever you want for whatever reason. We don't care. And we'll cover the balance. Now, come on. Some of you would say, yeah, all right. That's too good to be true. That can't be a checking account with an endless balance. Sure enough. I mean, what happens when you run out of money? Don't worry about it. Just keep writing checks. Believe me, the economy works great. As long as you keep spending, everything will be fine. Now, I don't know about you. I have a little bit of self-restraint. I can only spend so much. I can only eat so much. I can only drive so many cars. I can only own so many homes. You know, I can only buy so many family members' gifts. Eventually, I'll run out of things to think of to buy. Just don't have that much imagination when it comes to like this stuff. But you give it to certain people that I know, no problem, baby. Whatever, whenever, believe me, the lottery couldn't begin to touch. Well, Congress took off. It spends more money than it takes in and always has since Washington's days. It's spending way beyond its income. By the way, we are the ones that generate its income. But how can it do that? I mean, really? Spending into the red every single day of every single year? Basically, this is what happens. Let's say Congress needs an extra $1 billion today. So it goes to the Treasury and says, we want $1 billion. And the Treasury official says, you guys have got to be kidding. We don't have any money here. You spent it all a long time ago. Everything that we've taken in taxes, you fellows have spent by March. Congress says, we thought that was true, but we thought we'd stop by just in case somebody, you know, sent some more money in. They get together and they go down the street and they get the idea that we'll borrow the money. That's what we'll do. So they stop by at the printing office, and they don't print money at the printing office. They print certificates. And they have very fancy things with borders on the edge with an eagle across the top and a seal at the bottom, and it says U.S. government bond or note or bill, depending on the length of the maturity of it. If you hold it up to the light, it really says in the watermark, I owe you. That's because that's what it is. They print these things up, and it looks very impressive, and then they offer them to the private sector. They're hoping that people will come up and loan money to the federal government, and a lot of people do and are anxious to lend money to their government. And the bonds, they just snatch them up. They used to advertise them in World War II because, you know, mass media was really, you know, coming of age, newspapers and everything, and movies. It would always say, buy bonds. By the way, all those war bonds, you know, billions of dollars worth of war bonds that people bought, yeah, they never paid off. They all turned out to be worthless. But that's beside the point. Why do people loan money to the government? Because they've been told by their investment advisors that that's the most sound investment you can make. Buy T-bills. Buy treasury notes. Why? We've all heard that these loans are backed by the full faith and credit of the United States of America. They're not quite sure what that means, but it sure sounds good, doesn't it? I'd like to explain for you who are in doubt really what that means. The full faith and credit of the U.S. government means that the government solemnly promises to pay back that loan plus interest if it has to take everything you and I have in the form of taxes in order to do it. It's going to do it. Does that make sense? It will take everything we have, if necessary, to hold its pledge. Government will take everything the people has, if that's what's necessary, to hold its pledge to pay back the bonds, the loan that we gave the government. People don't realize that they're putting themselves on the line. They're going to get their money back minus a substantial handling fee. Plenty of money is loaned to the government, but never enough. Remember that checkbook I told you? Endless balance. Congress needs more money than that. But they say not to worry. Don't worry. The economy's going to grow. The gross national product goes up every year. They go further down the street to the Federal Reserve building. The Fed has been waiting for them. That's one of the reasons it was created in the first place. By the time they get inside the Federal Reserve building, the officer of the Fed is opening his desk drawer. He knows they're going to be there, and he's ready. And he pulls out his magic checkbook. And he writes a check to the U.S. Treasury for $1 billion, or whatever the amount is that they need that day. He signs the check, and he gives it to the Treasury official. Now, we need to stop here for a minute and ask a question. Where did the Federal Reserve get the $1 billion to give to the Treasury? I mean, who put that money into the account at the Federal Reserve system? The amazing answer is there is no money in the account at the Federal Reserve System. In fact, technically, there isn't even an account. there's only a checkbook. That's all. Just the magic checkbook. That $1 billion springs into being at precisely the instant the officer signs that check, and that is called monetizing the debt. That's the phrase they throw at you. That means they just wrote a check, big rubber one. If you and I were to do that, we would go to jail. But they can do it because Congress wants them to do it. In fact, this is the payoff. This is the benefit to the government side of this partnership. This is how the government gets its instant access to any amount of money at any time without having to go to the taxpayer directly and justify it or ask for it. Otherwise, they would have to come to the taxpayer. They would have to say, we're going to raise your taxes another $3,000 this year. And of course, if they did that, they would be voted out of office really fast. They like the Mandrake mechanism because it's a no questions asked source of money. You may have noticed that it's been years since Congress has been discussing what anything costs. It's not an issue. It doesn't make any difference what the cost is. Because regardless of the overrun, they know they can go down the street to the Federal Reserve and by law, the officer has to write that big check and give it to them. And then they're off and running. No worries. There, in a nutshell, is the reason the government likes the Mandrake mechanism. Obama spent $5 trillion in 4 years. No problem. No problem. Five with 12 zeros behind it. No problem. Easy, instant access to any amount of money of any kind without the taxpayer being involved directly in the loop. It's called taxation without representation. But what about the banking side? I mean, what do they get out of it? I mean, come on. They're writing these big fat rubber checks. Well, this is where it really gets interesting. Let's go back to the $1 billion check again. Got that in your mind? The Treasury official deposits the check into the government's checking account, and all of a sudden the computers start to click and it shows that the government has a $1 billion deposit, meaning that it can now write $1 billion in checks against the deposit, which it starts to do like 5 minutes later. For the sake of our analysis, let's just follow $100 out of that billion in a check that for some reason they write to the fellow that delivers the mail, let's say. The postal worker gets a check for $100 and he looks at this thing and he can't imagine in his wildest dreams that the money didn't exist 2 days ago anywhere in the universe. But it's spendable, so he wouldn't even care if you told him. He deposits it now into his personal checking account and boom, he can go to Walmart. Now, we're finally out of the Federal Reserve and out of the government's check and we're into the private banking system. We're in finally to that part of the partnership which is involved in the cartel. $100 deposit has now been made in the local bank. Remember, the postal worker deposited the $100 check. And the banker sees that and runs over to the loan window and he opens it up and says, hey, attention everybody, we have money to loan. Someone just deposited $100. Everyone is overjoyed at that because that's one of the reasons they come to the bank. They come to borrow money, right? That's a sign of national health if you're in debt. So they're anxious to know that the bank has money to loan, and they line up for these loans. They heard the banker, and they say $100 is not very much. He says, not to worry. We can make a loan up to $900 based on that $100 deposit. That's right. They can extend it 10 to 1. For every $100 that's deposited, the bank can loan out $900. Now, you see why. It's a really big problem if you go to the bank and say, hey, I want to withdraw my $100. Well, the bank says, well, no, wait a minute, Mr. Smith. You see, just a minor complication here. If you take your $100 out, we kind of loaned it out to nine other people. Now, we borrowed $900 to loan out to other people at interest. We borrowed the money at 0% interest based on your $100. And if you take your $100 out, then we don't have the cash to actually back our loan system. So, how about a toaster? Something. Now, you might not think this is possible, but listen to me very closely. Take the $100 and take it up to, say, $5 million. Now, Mr. Smith, I know you want to make this purchase or this investment or whatever you want to make, but if you take that $5 million out of our bank, it is a substantial impact upon our ability to loan. And so we're going to have to get your $5 million withdrawal approved. Well, Mr. Smith could say, now wait a minute, Mr. Banker, Dick, that's my $5 million, and I want it by 5 o'clock today. And it's none of your business what I do with it. If I invest it in a worm farm, it's of no concern to you. I earned it. It's my money. It's in my account, and I'm going to do with it what I want to do with it. And the banker, Richard, we'll call him Dick says, well, it's like this, Mr. Smith. We don't have your $5 million. We'll have to order it. It'll take a few weeks to come in. You'll have to sign some forms. There'll be a DNA sample, and we need photographs of your firstborn and a thumbprint because we have new regulations in place that don't allow you to take your $5 million out of the bank and do with whatever you want to do with it. We want to make sure you're not going to do something that's going to harm the country with your $5 million. And trust me, that is exactly what is happening up there. When I tell you that there are not 500 people in the United States of America today that could write a check for $5 million Monday morning, tomorrow morning, I'm telling you the truth. They could not. There is not $5 million of liquid cash for more than 500 people in a country of 330 million people. How can that be done? It gets complicated the way they do it, and I'll tell you in very simple terms. The Federal Reserve System requires that the banks hold no less than 10% of their deposits in reserve. The bank holds 10% of that $100 in reserve, $10, and it loans this first fellow in line $90. What does he do with it? Well, he wants to spend it, so he puts it into his checking account. In fact, it probably goes directly into his checking account. It doesn't go into savings. Nobody does that. Let's assume that they gave it to him and he puts it back. When he puts it back, it's a deposit, isn't it? Only a $100 deposit, but $900 in loans, and that deposit is still there. Where did the $900 come from? And the answer is the same. There was no money. This springs into existence precisely at the point at which the loan is made. Notice the difference. An important distinction is when the money is created out of nothing for the government, it is spent by the government. On the banking side, however, when it's created out of nothing, it's not spent by the banks. It's loaned by the banks to you and to me, and we spend it. Notice that when they loan it to us, we have to pay them interest on it. Now, you just think about this for a minute. The money was created out of nothing, and yet they collect interest on it, which means that they collect interest on nothing. No risk to them at all. They didn't make the money. They didn't earn the money. They did nothing for the money, and yet they get interest on it. And that's not too shabby, right? What a concept. What a concept. A magic checkbook that you can make interest back to the bank on as much as you can loan. The only stipulation is that you got to have 10% of it on reserve. You got to get people to deposit their money into your bank so you can go to the Federal Reserve and you can pull that cash out for nothing. Now you see what the benefit is to the banking cartel for being involved in the Federal Reserve System. Interest on nothing. The process does not end there, however. It has consequences to you and me. I've heard some people say, isn't that interesting? These fellows are sure smart. I guess they deserve to be rich. It's as though we, the people, are out of the loop. It's called taxation without representation. It is exactly, precisely what the Founding Fathers warned us about. It is exactly why Jefferson, Franklin, and the others did not want a central bank. It is why the Revolutionary War was fought. It was why we went to war. We shot cannons and rifles and launched ships and everything we had against it, and we won our independence. And in 1910, seven men put us right back under the same thing. The partnership between government and banks, which we've been discussing, was not new with the Federal Reserve System. In fact, it was a concept that was created in Europe in the 16th century. It was perfected with the formation of the Bank of England in 1694. And from that point forward, all the governments of Europe had used this mandrake mechanism. They controlled the money supply. They inflated it and they collapsed it to keep evaporating and recreating the middle class. From the Bank of England forward, all the governments of Europe had central banks for a very good reason. The kings and the princes of Europe had learned from hard experience that they could raise the taxes of their subjects only so high. And then they had a revolt on their hands, and they tended to lose their jobs and their heads. It appears that natural level was about 40 to 43% of the people. That's the kind of tax level that they understand. Then they start digging in their heels and they just won't allow it to go any further. But with the central bank mechanism in place, the lid was off. Now these governments could tax their people at 50, 60, 70%, and in some cases 80% of everything they produced. And they still did not have a revolution on their hands. They did not have resentment because the people didn't know that they were paying a tax. They knew prices were going up, but they didn't understand why. They didn't know who was getting their lost purchasing power. It was a nifty arrangement for these governments. It was at this point in history that government wars began to heat up. They also had wars, but they were relatively small. They always had wars, but they're relatively small, because wars are expensive and people don't pay more than 40% for everything, including wars. And by the way, mostly poor people and middle class people lose their lives. But now they had a way to tax higher than that. They could engage in very expensive wars with very elaborate and devastating weapons. And it's at that point in history that Europe plunged headlong into continuous war and big, very, very expensive wars. And the people paid for them uncomplainingly through the process of inflation. Oh, you don't think inflation has been rampant lately? No? Have you bought a can of soup lately? Have you bought a package of dehydrated mushrooms lately? Have you gone to the store and bought a gallon of milk or roasted peanuts or cheese? Have you bought a bag of potato chips lately? $2 for $7. $2 for $7? For 7 ounces of potatoes? The most common vegetable in the entire United States? Are you kidding me? No, I'm not kidding you. Inflation to the tune of, not 10. No, not 10 or 15%, not 25%. How about 60 to 400%? Absolutely true. So when it came time to transplant this concept to America in 1910, these seven men on Jekyll Island knew very well that they were creating a central bank. That was the reason that Paul Warburg, a naturalized American, was so valuable, because he was the man with the intense knowledge, the detailed technical knowledge of how central banks operate. He was from Europe. But they had a problem. How could they conceal that from the American people? Because Congress was already on record as saying they did not want a central bank in America. We fought one hell of a war over it. I don't think they knew what that phrase really meant, but they knew that Europe had them, whatever they were, and we didn't want any. They said in America, if we're going to have banking reform, we don't want what they do over in Europe. We want something that is unique for America and its principles and economy. The problem before these men on Jekyll Island is, come on, guys, we have a very complex sales job to do here. How do we get this past the, well, you know, the American people? Well, they theorized over this, and this was their strategy. It must have come to them over very premium cigars and very well-aged scotch. They said, let's first give it a name, and we'll add the word federal to it to make it sound like it's government, you know. And then we'll add the word reserve to it to make it seem like there are reserves somewhere, you know, like it was a banking concept. And then we'll add the word system, a very important word, even though it may seem obscure now, because remember in those days the concern was the concentration of financial power in New York. Remember we talked about the central banks in New York, the big banks. So they had to sell the idea of a system of regional banks which would diffuse that power all over the nation. First, they talked about 10 regions, and then they said, that's not enough. Let's have 12 regions. We'll have 12 banks, and we'll build big buildings out there in all these regions so the local yokels can go back and look at that building and say, golly, we've got one of those out here. Diffusion of power away from New York. You can go up and you can touch the building. You can walk inside, and the architecture will be amazing, and it will be like, there's money here. Don't make too much noise in the bank. We're on good behavior in the bank. Inside tones in the bank. The word system was very important. We'll make them look like churches with big columns and marble and brass. And when you look at it, you'll realize that what they created there was not federal. There are no reserves. It's not a system at all, in the sense of diffusion of power. And these Federal Reserve banks, well, they aren't even really banks. On all four words, we're dealing with appearances of the fourth kind. And it was absolutely brilliant. The next thing was to sell this Frankenstein to the public. Well, the first draft of the Federal Reserve Act, as it was presented to Congress, was called the Aldrich Bill. You know, named after the sponsor. We have Dodd-Frank and we have, you know, various things like that. Senator Nelson Aldrich. Well, this was against good advice of Paul Warburg. He said, Nelson, don't put your name on that bill because you are so identified with big business interests that Congress will vote it down, that people will not accept it. And apparently Aldrich's ego was, well, just a little too big. He was, after all, a sitting U.S. senator. It was my train that you rode on down here. He must have said, well, no. After all, I am highly respected in the Senate, and I am the chairman of the National Monetary Commission. And for whatever reason, he insisted that his name be on the bill. It appears that he wanted to go down in history as the originator of the Federal Reserve System. However, Warburg was right. When the bill was introduced to Congress, thumbs down, baby, it was the bill of big business. They tanked it. They took the bill back, for it was just a minor setback. They scrambled the paragraphs around a little bit, took Aldrich's name off real fast, and they found a couple of Democrats to sponsor the bill. Excuse me, a little grapefruit juice. You know how we always associate big business with Republicans. Well, we'll put a couple of Democrats' names on it. You know, the common man, the little guy, the worker class. You know, like Ted Kennedy. Well, they found a couple of millionaire Democrats, not hard to do in Washington. Mr. Harry Reid entered Congress with, or entered the Senate with no real visible means of income. His personal net worth, well over $20 million now. How do you get a net worth of over $20 million with an income of a little over $200,000 a year? I don't know. I don't have an answer for it. Anyway, they found Carter Glass in the House and Senator Robert Owen, who himself was a banker. Now, this, of course, was called the Glass-Owen Bill, and it was totally different, and, of course, it was acceptable. The next thing, Aldrich and Vanderlip began to give speeches and interviews to newspaper reporters condemning the bill. Because, after all, it was Democrats that were on it. They said, this bill will be ruinous to banking. It will be terrible for the country. And by the time the common man read that in his newspaper, he said, ha, well, I guess these big bankers are having their goose handed to them now. All cooked. These big bankers don't like this bill very much, do they? So therefore, it must be pretty good. In its simplest form, the protection racket is instantiated by the mafia when they claim money off clients to protect them from a danger that is, in fact, the mafia itself. Now, this was a masterful form of marketing. To have the crafters of the bill come out against the bill. And, of course, reporters were doing the same job then that they do today. The friendly little fuzzy lapdog media hopped up in the lap of the Democrats and were petted and smiled in front of whatever cameras could get in front of the people, and the people voted it in. And then began the process of securitization. This whole process of creating something out of nothing. You remember when the system was originally created, a man would work for whatever he was worth, an hour, a day, a month. That would be converted into a promise to pay, a contract, a piece of paper, a note, cash. He could then take that value that was handed to him by his employer who got the value of his worth. He could then take that promise to pay somewhere else and could trade it for beans, potatoes, a car, clothes, a house, equipment, whatever he needed. And that business would take that promise to pay and then, in fact, pay its suppliers and so forth. And the money would go around and around through the system, and it was a wonderful thing. It simplified the barter system by providing a consistent and universal system of exchange. However, you know, banks don't actually create anything. They don't generate anything. Their purpose in life is to export cash from the community, export value from the community to another location. Now, when the banking system first started out, even after 1910, you had county banks, and then you had state banks, and then you had interstate banks. Slowly but surely, national banks became more and more common. Even though from state to state, you know, different kinds of commissions would block, say, Bank of America or Wells Fargo or Wachovia or whatever bank being in more than one state and doing interstate commerce. But one by one, the smaller banks were bought out by larger banks, becoming more and more efficient. And pretty soon the people didn't care. In fact, the people said, hey, I kind of like it. You know, I have a Bank of America card and I can go from Florida to California and I can get money out of my account without having to pay that $2 fee. I can walk into a bank in Knoxville, Tennessee or New York or Miami and it's my bank and I like it. And so it's convenient to the customer. And so we have swallowed it just like the blue pill. No question. We're right smack in the middle of the matrix. But since banks don't actually create any value, they have to have a way to create value. And so they create this security racket. I argue that it has been at the core of the political economy of global capitalism over recent decades. Both the main processes of securitization function as forms of racketeering and in this respect as symbolic weapons of mass deception on a global scale. Symbolic weapons that, however, also do actually material work on several levels that eventually even undermines sociality itself. Indeed, the great political theorist Charles Tilly has conceptualized war-making and state-making as a form of protection racket. States emerged as powerful institutions which extracted wealth from those they controlled, returning nothing, little else but the promise to limit the extent of plunder and to keep other plunderers at bay. Tilly argues that the logic of the protection racket applies to some extent also in war-making and state-making, only with the added advantage that this is perceived as legitimate. So let's use the global war on terror as an example. Based on the most comprehensive available empirical documentation and statistics, we find that non-state terrorism is a marginal danger to human life. I mean, seriously, less people die in Baghdad than die in Chicago. Okay? Less people have died in the entire Afghan war than die in 1 or 2 years on Chicago streets. In the 40-year period from 1968, that's when data's first recorded, until 2007, 50,000 people globally have been killed due to terrorism on the entire planet. In Western Europe, the number is 1,400, North America 3,500, including the 3,000 victims of 9/11. However, the actual dangers to world stability from the activities of the pan-Islamic terrorist networks against which America proclaimed its global war, or for that matter from the sum total of all the terrorist movements anywhere in the world, are negligible. The insignificance of these terrorism figures can be brought into sharp relief when compared to the fact that every half hour of every day, every half hour, every 30 minutes of every day in America, a person is murdered, totaling about 17,000 victims a year. Every 6 minutes in America, someone is forcibly raped. Every minute, a robbery takes place. Every 38 seconds, someone is assaulted. This is just regular sidewalk stuff in America. This is America. I'm not talking about the really dangerous places to live. Taken together, the actual threat posed by non-state terrorism, the political rhetoric and public attention, and not the least, the real political and military consequences of the global war on terror, fit nicely the scheme of the protection security racket. Considering government actions as racketeering, Tilly writes, since governments themselves commonly simulate, or even fabricate threats of external war, and since the repression and extraction activities of governments often constitute the largest current threats to the livelihoods of their own citizens, many governments operate in essentially the same ways as racketeers. Okay? This is called plutocracy. Plutarchs. They're basically criminals that are in place of government. And they run criminal activities against the people of the nation, but because they're government and they wear a badge or they have some kind of authority, a judge or some kind of officer of an agency, whether it's enforcement or fines or taxation without representation, it doesn't matter. As early as September of 2001, at the inception of the global war on terror, this would have been about, let's see, the buildings went down September 1st. It probably didn't take them 3 weeks, sometime in late September. Bush famously declared that either you are with us or you are with the terrorists. Fancy words. And we bought up every American flag that could be sold. You couldn't find one in a dollar store or a Walmart anywhere in the country. And this presaged the establishment of extreme repressive powers. You'll remember, don't you? Well, come on, guys. We voted it in. The CIA received legal authority by the president to assassinate alleged terrorists all over the world. And we've been doing it. We've been using drones. We've been using poisons. We've been using whatever. What do you think the kill list is? These aren't city blocks that we used to wipe out like we did in World War II or the Korean War. No, no, no. We can pinpoint right in between a set of earrings anybody we want, and we've been doing it. That's the way we conduct war now. We don't go after the ideology. We go after the individual. The current U.S. policies and the war on terror have tried to revive the apocalyptic terrors of the Cold War. You know what I'm talking about. Yeah, we can't let Iran get the nuclear weapon. Nah, 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 nah. When they no longer have any plausibilities by inventing enemies that legitimize expansion and the use of its global power. You know, aircraft carriers, nuclear submarines, B-52s, eyes in the sky, satellites, on and on and on. $1.2 trillion a year to go after the enemy. What enemy? You know, terror. Isn't that a little bit like jealousy? Isn't that a little bit like, bad mood, anger, frustration? A war against frustration? Is that what we're talking about here? A war against a bad attitude. A war against anything that would be anti-government. Whose government? Well, listen, it doesn't really matter. U.S. interests. Anybody that's against U.S. interests is a terrorist. What about the American people that might be against U.S. government? Are we the enemy too? Are we the enemy too? But let us not forget that insights about the fostering and fabrications of enemies in the interest of elite rulers have been acknowledged in political philosophy, at least as far back as, Machiavelli, who stated, "Therefore, many judge that a wise prince must, whenever he has the occasion, foster with cunning some hostility, so that in stamping it out, his greatness will increase as a result." Got to have an enemy, to have a legacy. And with the U.S. in a leading role, the international community of state powers have inflated, fabricated, directed a terror threat out of all proportions that has created cultures of fear. Oh, come on. You don't believe me? Turn the cable news on. It's 24 hours a day. Every 30 minutes, it's recycled. It's sent into your brain, this culture of fear, from which the very same state powers might legitimate securitization and militarization as protection of the people who are, allegedly, potential victims of the inflated threat, even if we are the enemy. Now you see how it works. And maybe we'll discuss this more as the year goes on. All right, we're coming up to the top of the hour. I'm going to change gears a little bit here. We've spent a couple hours on this. By the way, you'll remember October 2009, President Barack Obama signed the 2010 Defense Authorization Act, the largest military budget in U.S. and world history. Yeah, that's it, the biggest. In 2009, the defense budget was $651 billion, and you thought that was big, compared to the 2000 budget of only $281 billion. That's over double. It is more than doubled in 10 years, and importantly, the defense budget is in reality much larger because the defense budget excludes many military items that are hidden within other state budgets. You know, non-U.S. aggregate real expenditure on military worldwide in 2007 remained at approximately the 1998 level, about $500 billion. Most years, terrorism victims are zero in the U.S. You got that? Zero. I'm talking about 0.0. The most comprehensive database for terrorism statistics was the MIPT Terrorism Knowledge Database. The database was available for the public online. Anybody could see it. Well, I mean, you can't now. It was only available until the 31st of March, 2008. The database was run by a nonprofit organization, but it was, of course, funded through the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and integrated data from a number of sources, the RAND Terrorism Chronology and RAND MIPT Terrorism Incident Databases, the Terrorism Indictment Database, blah, blah, blah. All of these organizations fed information into it. Now, when TKB ceased operation as the most comprehensive terrorism incident database, the website announced that it was to be integrated with the so-called Global Terrorism Database. That's now called the GTD. It's organized very differently from the former TKB, with far less valuable functionality for analysis, where precise tools and data were openly available to the public through the TKB online with sources cited. You now have to contact GTD to get access to parts of the data sets. Wikipedia describes TKB the following way. Quote, the TKB contains historical information on terrorism dating back to 1968 with over 29,000 incident profiles, 900 group profiles, and 1,200 leader biographies. The TKB is a free website and contains several features to analyze terrorism data, including graphing tools, interactive maps, and statistical summaries. The TKB ceased operations on the 31st of March, 2008. Most deaths from terrorism in the United States, most years, is zero. Now let's talk about a war on terror that spends $1.2 trillion a year. $1.2 trillion a year against zero deaths per year. Does that make sense to you? It certainly does not make sense to me. So let's listen to some music just a little bit. I won't play the whole song because I got a ton of stuff to cover, and I know you people are interested, and I want to set something right. 2 weeks ago, I talked about Payne Androv's work. December 23rd of this year, we're supposed to be aligned with the galactic plane, and this mighty wave is coming to turn our sun into a red giant. I want to sort of settle that down a little bit and give you everyone a little bit more hope that there is going to be a 2013, because there will be. We'll be right back. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming to you right after this.
Goodbye, Milky Way.
Back to the third hour of X Squared Radio, December 2nd, 2012. The Goodbye Milky Way from Enigma. Love this song. Just has the coolest sound about it. As we get into this third hour, I wanted to kind of cool off a little bit of what was said a couple of weeks ago here on this program. We covered Payne Androff's work. And the conclusion was that December 23rd of this year, there was going to be a pulse come from the massive spinning black hole in the center of the galaxy, and it was going to cause our sun to begin to go into a red giant phase. And although, you know, the science appears to be pretty good, the evidence points to the fact that there is an X-ray jet coming out of the top and the bottom of the Milky Way galaxy, and that this pulse may be coming at us at far less than the speed of light, which should arrive on or about that day. Whether it will have that effect on our sun, which is actually a middle-aged sun, not at all old and not ready to go into a red giant phase. It's kind of small, too, to be able to go into a red giant phase. I'm not saying that that will happen or not happen, but certainly there will be a geophysical changes to all the planets in the solar system. It appears that those changes are ramping up, that all the planets in the solar system are warming somewhat. Even the moons of those planets are jetting the stuff out into the solar system. So, and the other thing is I want to make sure that you have a clear vision of hope, because the fact that there are 7 billion of us here at this time involved with this Earth is no coincidence. You're here alive by no chance. It was no chance that the Industrial Revolution happened when it did, that allowed this planet to support many, many, many more times the life that it could the previous 100,000 years, that we could grow more crops, clean more water, communicate instantaneously around the planet, move untold numbers of tons of material around the planet at almost a moment's notice, by ship, by sea, by air, by train, by truck. This is no coincidence. All of this is here so that we could be here. We're here for a reason. Our consciousness is involved in the Earth's transition. What is the nature of that transition? Search your own soul. Search your own soul to see what the nature of that involvement between your soul and this planet and the nature of that transition. Because I believe, even though it is a planetary deal, it is an individual deal. the energy that you maintain in your own body will determine your own judgment. There is no master judge in the universe, only a master system that has been jointly created by all the sentient beings in it, so that we basically go where our friends are. You're not going to be raised in the light and live your life in the light your entire life, and just because of your poverty or your race or your lack of freedom, you will be assigned to some dark and dingy, damp area of the universe. Not so. It is an internal energy that each one of us hold, and that internal energy, when combined with others of like energy, concentrated and motivated and conscious and awake, it can change the future. In fact, it can choose the future, not necessarily change the future. All of those futures occur, which one we as a collective here on the planet Earth go through is a choice made by the sentient beings on this planet. Does that mean the prophets are wrong? No. Not any more than if you had a vision of you having the soup in the future and you decide with that newfound knowledge that you don't want the soup, you're going to take the salad. It doesn't mean the prophets are wrong. Prophecy is a conditional prediction. This is what is going to happen if you do this or if you do not do this. But if you do that or do not do that, then you have chosen a new future. You have been empowered with the knowledge of the prophets. And you have said, I don't want to go to Armageddon, and so we do not. I don't want to be consumed in a red giant, and we are not. No, maybe an Earth will be consumed in a red giant, but not the one you're on. And maybe that's what the Maya saw. Not the Maya. And I would say that, generally speaking, the Maya people were quite wicked in their practices of cannibalism and human sacrifices. But Pakal, the mighty king, the mighty giant king who recorded all of this on his tomb lid, which was discovered in 1958, that's quite a different story. The vision of the king, the understanding of the king, was quite a bit different than the practices of the priests that followed him. Now, let's talk about a bunch of small articles here that are going to make a lot of sense to you, even if I stitch them together. You've heard about the Large Hadron Collider, right? This is the one in Switzerland where they've been slamming hydrogen ions together at near the speed of light. When beams of particles crash into each other at high speeds, the collisions yield hundreds of new particles, most of which fly away like broken glass that shards shining for a billionth of a second. And we record those frequencies and thus learn something about the particle that we just smashed apart. Somehow, these particles, we've done it enough times now that we know they fly at the same direction, even though it's not clear how they can communicate their direction with one another. And that has really surprised a lot of people. A lot of scientists that have been looking at this don't understand the pattern of how these particles fly apart. They're supposed to be random, you know, kind of all over the place, but that's not what's happening. And a paper describing the unexpected findings will appear in the upcoming issue of the journal Physical Review B. It is now available online, although I don't think any of you are interested in reading it. The MIT Heavy Ion Group, which includes Roland and some MIT physicists, physics professors, Bullock, Weislauch, Witt Busa, saw the same distinctive pattern in proton-proton collisions about 2 years ago. The same flight pattern is also seen when ions of lead or other heavy metals, such as gold and copper, collide with each other. Yeah, they accelerate gold ions the same way, pretty close to the speed of light, which means they have to pour a tremendous amount of energy into these things, and they go from one or two electron volts up to, you know, several tera electron volts, which means they are massive when they collide. You know, as these things approach the speed of light, mass gets close to infinity anyway, so these things are quite large and quite massive when they slam into each other. And those heavy ion collisions produce a wave of quark-gluon plasma. It's sort of like splattering two water balloons together, you know, full of phosphorescent or fluorescent algae. The hot soup of particles that existed for the first few millionths of a second after the Big Bang. In the collider, this wave sweeps some of the resulting particles in the same direction, accounting for the correlation in their flight paths. We don't understand that. These things, you know, are slamming head on like two cars, you know, crossing the center line in the freeway. Well, to have the mirrors and tires and various parts of the car fly in the same direction every single time, you know, you've done that before. You drop a quarter and you can't find it. Have you ever done this before? I mean, you heard it hit, but you've looked everywhere and you can't find it, or a tool under the car. And then you say, well, let's drop another one. So, I mean, I lost my half-inch socket. I don't know where it rolled because I wasn't actually watching. I only heard it. So I'm going to drop the 9/16 socket, and I'll see where it goes. And darn if it doesn't land pretty close to where the half-inch socket was, and you find it. What do you mean you've never tried that? Yeah, I have done it. I have. No, I didn't lose the 9/16 socket too. I found both sockets because I dropped it, and it went the same way. As it turns out, it's the same way with those pesky protons. It has been theorized that proton-proton collisions may produce a liquid-like wave of gluons known as color glass condensate. This dense swarm of gluons may also produce the unusual collision pattern seen in proton-lead collisions. The correlation is, it's a very tiny effect, but it's pointing to something very fundamental about how quarks and gluons are arranged spatially within a proton. It kind of means that it's, even though we don't know what's inside a proton, you know, we have protons and neutrons and electrons that make up all matter that we know of in the universe. And neutrons are identical to protons except that a electron has been added to it, thus neutralizing it, you know, plus one minus one equals zero, which is a neutron. And it is these highly energetic neutrons that make up virtually every fission and fusion system that we have on the Earth. We know how they work. We just don't know why they work. And as it turns out, we're not talking about a hologram. Well, maybe we are talking about a hologram, but the pieces of the hologram are in specific places inside that proton. That being said, it means that there's a front end and a back end and a left-hand side and a right-hand side, you know, up and down, because the head-on collision in cars means that the front bumper of one car smacks into the front bumper of the other car, you know, headlight to headlight, grill to grill, radiator to radiator. But is that really so in protons as well? As it turns out, it may be. You don't expect quark-gluon plasma effects with lead-proton collisions. You know, we're talking about a whole bunch of protons. Lead is very dense. It was supposed to be a sort of reference run, you know, a run in which you can study background effects and then subtract them from the effects that you see in the lead-lead collisions. That run lasted only 4 hours, but in January, the CMS collaboration plans to do several weeks of lead-proton collisions, which should allow them to establish whether the collisions really are producing a liquid. This should help narrow down the possible explanations and determine if the effect seen in proton-proton, and lead-lead collisions are related. Kind of interesting stuff if you're into physics. I just thought I should let you know. And by the way, you know, we're talking fusion and fission here. Nuclear space motors. Now that would be a cool car company. But it's not. Researchers have tested a small prototype of a nuclear reactor engine design that could one day power deep space exploration probes. That's not new. We have used nuclear-powered engines and batteries to power spacecraft in the past. But they've been really heavy. They have a lot of shielding, you know, just in case launching it up there doesn't go well and it starts coming back down. You know, everybody would be scattering because, oh my gosh, we have a nuclear engine that's crashing back to Earth. The proposed design is based on a Stirling engine, an engine first invented in the 19th century. That uses hot pressurized gas to push a piston. You know, you know what I'm talking about. It would use a 50-pound nuclear uranium battery to generate heat that is then carried to 8 Stirling engines to produce about 500 watts of power. Steam power. You know, a steam engine. Scientists at NASA's Glenn Research Center and Los Alamos National Laboratory have tested a pared-down prototype of this design using a small nuclear source and a single Stirling engine that produced about 24 watts of energy. Now, come on, you used to have one just like that. Yeah, you know, you would fill up the little boiler with water, right? You could see the little glass thing, or you had a little sight glass that you could fill it up so far. And then you, you know, had oil, and you lit it off, and it would heat that thing up, and then the steam engine would start running, you know, a tabletop one. And if you just tuned it just right, the little flywheel would spin like mad. You could get the thing up to about 6,000 RPM there on your table. It was a great, you know, science project. It was all, you know, stainless steel or chrome, and it's kind of fun if you've never played with a little steam engine. Same principle, except we're using a nuclear battery to heat it up instead of a little kerosene. Most deep space probes require only about 600 to 700 watts of power. So it will, you know, still be a while before this test produces something capable of powering a spacecraft. 24 watts, 600 to 700 watts. It's going to take a pretty good sized steam engine. But this is the first test of a nuclear reactor system to power a spacecraft conducted in the U.S. since 1965. Nuclear engines are important because they make possible exploration into space. Let me just do one real quick thing here because I can't talk and type at the same time. Okay. Now, I wish I could learn to do that. Say one thing and type another thing, but then you have like, you know, Mamu Dogface and the Banana Patch coming out in your typed words. It's kind of interesting stuff that we're going to put this out there. And it isn't just going to be government, you know. There is also talk about, deep space exploration done on the private sector. Oh, yeah. We're not talking about just, you know, governments doing this. Elon Musk, when a man tells you about the time he planned to put a vegetable garden on Mars, you have a tendency to worry about his mental state, even though right here on my arm, I hold it up to the camera. Oh, that's right. We're not on TV this week. You see, the atmospheric river, we're going to talk about that in just a little bit, has been just beating the crap out of the California coast this week. And so there in Paradise, California, it is not paradise. And the rain and the wind have really lay a whooping on the internet and on the speed of the packets, that's what we call them, in the webcast business, are kind of corrupted, able to handle audio, but we're not able to get the video out this week. So you can't see this on my arm. But on my arm is a black rubber band. You know, a lot of you have them, like, what would Jesus do? Mine says Exgenesis. And on the top of it, it says, Settling the Future. It is a private company that has in mind a plan to populate Mars. That might be a little high altitude. You might have to spend a little time indoors. No big deal. Humans only spent 15% of their time outside anyway, even on this planet. But, as going back to the man with the garden on Mars, if that same man has since launched multiple rockets that are actually capable of reaching Mars, sending them into orbit, Bond style, from a tiny island in the Pacific, well, you need to find another diagnosis. That's the thing about extreme entrepreneurialism. There's a fine line between madness and genius, and you need a little bit of both to really change the world. However, remember, one great idea and you're a genius. Two great ideas and you're a crackpot. Elon Musk is also the CEO of Tesla Motors. You know, the little $110,000 electric Lotus sports car. Kind of set the standard for electric vehicles in America, even though it's a little pricey by our standards, yours and mine standards. It's kind of a toy for the rich and famous. His second brainchild, he doesn't just want to send a person to Mars. He wants to send 80,000 people to Mars, according to space.com. The billionaire founder and CEO of the private spaceflight company, SpaceX. He's also the founder and CEO of Tesla Motors. Remember what I said about two great ideas. Earlier this year, and we've covered it on this program, SpaceX became the first private U.S. company to deliver cargo to the International Space Station. It's always been done by government craft up till that time. Musk has never been shy about his ambitions to take human colonists to another planet, mentioning in the past that he wants to provide flights to Mars for about $500,000 a person. I'm in. I'm in, dudes. If I've got 10 million, if I win the lottery, I'm putting my deposit down. But now he's talking about building a small city-sized settlement on the red planet, a la Martian Chronicles. Starting with a 10-person crew in the coming decades to begin establishing and building infrastructure, and Elon's young enough to do it. That first flight would be expensive and risky, but once there, regular Mars flights. You can get the cost down to about $500,000 for someone who wants to move to Mars. Things get a little rough here, or if you think you have what it takes to multitask, wear multiple hats, you know, be able to build a home and maintain it in terrible conditions with 1/100 the atmospheric pressure that we have here, temperatures going down to, 90 below zero? Easy enough. Anyway, there might be enough people who would buy it. It would be one way to export all the rich people from this planet, wouldn't it? Science fiction-inspired plans are one thing, but this is real. I think it is so cool. Don't you? I think it is. I think it is. You're not a rocket scientist by training. You're not a space engineer. And Elon says, well, that's true. My background educationally is physics and economics, and I grew up in a sort of engineering environment. My father was an electromechanical engineer, and so there were lots of engineering things around me. When I asked for an explanation, I got the true explanation of how things worked. I also did things like make model rockets, and in South Africa there were no pre-made rockets. I had to go to the chemist and get the ingredients for the rocket fuel mix and put it in a pipe, and then off it went. So Elon's one of the great American entrepreneurs, I think. Now, in the news, it comes up every now and then. We don't really know what to do about it. Lots and lots of people have recorded it. Some people say they can hear it, not me, of course, because I have these headphones on, and headphones, after a number of years, even if you have it at very low volume, will take their toll on your hearing. So if you hear me go, huh? It's because I don't have my headphones on and I can't hear what you're saying. The Earth seems to have a hum. The global hum of the Earth is now helping scientists probe the planet's deep interior, a group of researchers say. Wonder what they found. Since this hum, called seismic noise, which is generated by sources such as storm-driven ocean waves, is detectable everywhere on Earth, it could help scientists analyze the innards of the planet worldwide. Investigators added in a new study detailed in the November 23rd issue of the journal Science. She blinded me with science. Traditionally, researchers peer into the interior of the Earth by analyzing seismic waves generated by earthquakes. You recall the paper by Washington University's Dr. Y. Sessions and his 600 grad students, or grad students that went through 600,000 seismograms, detecting the damping waves of another ocean underneath the Atlantic Ocean. This is the way seismic waves zip through the planet, depending on physical properties of the Earth's inside, such as rock composition, temperature, pressure. As such, the way the waves behave offers useful clues and details of Earth's geology, you know, the planetary core geology. It's kind of an MRI of the Earth, or a CAT scan. With these waves, seismologists produced images in a way similar to medical imaging. The problem with this strategy is that it depends on earthquakes, and large earthquakes are kind of rare. So you have to wait a long time to really get a good picture, and, well, maybe you ran out of budget, and you don't have the grad students around to kind of catch that wave when it happens, so it takes a while to make an image. In addition to seismic waves from earthquakes, the interior of the Earth is pervaded by this seismic noise, a collective hum resulting from the bombardment of Earth's surface by a variety of sources, such as the swelling of oceans during storms. And let me tell you, this time of year, there are a lot more storms than there are earthquakes. The noise was regarded as useless and even problematic, since it's kind of a white noise and you really want a quiet background. It kind of hides the earthquake's signals. However, in recent years, by analyzing large amounts of seismic data collected over time, investigators successfully followed ambient seismic noise waves as they rippled across Earth's surface. Now, scientists reveal that they can also use ambient noise to image Earth's deep interior. The advantage of this strategy is that ambient noise imaging can be applied in regions that don't have earthquakes. Makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? The scientists installed 42 seismic recording stations in northern Finland and compared seismic noise signals between each station. By filtering out earthquake signals and ambient seismic noise surface waves, they were able to reconstruct how ambient seismic noise rippled through the Earth. Finland was a good place because it's very old, it has a homogeneous crust. Its old age meant that it had little in the way of new activity to confuse the readings. In other words, it was seismically quiet. Using this data, the researchers imaged the transition zone, separating the upper and lower layers of Earth's mantle, the main layer just below Earth's crust. The top of the mantle was about, 9 miles thick and 255 miles from the Earth's surface, while its bottom was about 2.5 miles thick and about 410 miles from the Earth's surface. It's still not quite deep enough to discover whether the Earth is hollow or not, because you'd have to go down about 900 miles, or about twice as deep as what they're able to do with this hum. However, the differences between the top and bottom are due to changes in crystal structure, resulting from how pressure varies according to depth. These changes of microstructures resulted in an increase of seismic speeds, which, you know, they'll eventually detect when the waves reflect on the layers where they occur. Ambient noise is another element in the geophysicist's toolbox. The study suggests that it could be developed everywhere, not just Finland, but everywhere, allowing for new collections of observations at the global scale. So I imagine that the 42 geophones, or these listening stations, are going to expand, maybe to 400, maybe to 4,000. And when they get this network of listening stations around the planet, they might be able to go deeper than 410 miles. In fact, they most certainly will, because the damping waves that they will pick up will be time sensitive. That is to say, they'll travel through multiple layers of rock, and they'll be delayed by time. And that time delay, or that Doppler effect, can be used to stratify and thus look at whether we're looking at very, or determine whether we're looking at very deep structures or relatively shallow structures. I can see where 42 listening points located across a vast area of Finland would be able to look that deep. But as you get further and further away, you can then do triangulation, and you should be able to look even deeper than that with much more precision. So I look for the study to grow. Hopefully, the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition can add a little more information to that as well. On the medical side, I have a couple of things I want to cover. First is the virus-free vaccine. You know, some statements have been made, if 80% of the people would just get the flu shot, we could do away with the flu virus. The idea behind that is that it's the human being that is the host or the breeding ground for the flu virus, and that's why every October or so, flu breaks out, because people are carrying it year-round. They just don't get sick from it. So as it gets to that time of year, we start getting a little cool weather. People's immune systems kick in. The antibodies go after the antigens, creating mutations, and that's what pops out a new flu virus. Two things. One is the virulent part of the flu virus, which is just a big molecule that's carried around in a macrophage. A macrophage is like a little spaceship. And it can have various shapes. It can look like a little crystal, like a little a top or a dreidel, or it can look like a spiral, like a conch shell or a little spirochete shell. And that shell can remain pretty intact and pretty docile until certain conditions of the body are formed, and then the macrophage lyses or comes apart, or it tends to connect to a cell like a key and a lock, and when it does, the macrophage injects the chromosomes, the DNA material, into the cell, and the cell replicates the virus, and boom, you're sick. The virulent side of that long molecule is what goes through the mutation. But the stem of it, that is to say the trunk of the virus, does not undergo the mutation, because that part of the protein folds and unfolds and replicates almost identical every single time, billions and trillions and gazillions of times. New viral technology has been developed not to attack the virulent side, but to attack the trunk side of the virus. Why has it not been put out into the public? Some people would say, oh, you know, big pharmacology, they're not about curing anything, they only want to treat. That's true. That's true. But you don't just introduce a new virus or a new vaccine which can go after the trunk of a virus, because it also happens to be exactly the same mechanism by which biochemistry works. Molecular biology is kind of unique that way. If you develop a vaccine that goes after the trunk of the flu virus, you may actually be developing a vaccine against life itself. Yeah, now you understand why you don't just jump out there with a new vaccine. The new vaccine strategy could make flu shots cheaper, safer, and easier to produce. And it's sort of like Monsanto does with the GMO, you know, genetically modified organisms. Well, now we're talking about genetically modified vaccines. Instead, they use synthetic messenger RNA instead of proteins purified from viruses. German scientists have shown they can protect mice, ferrets, and pigs against influenza. Now, it's a very interesting new approach. Hans-Dieter Klenk, a virologist at the University of Marburg in Germany, who is not involved in the work, he has everything to gain from this, in the magazine Science Now. Most flu vaccines consist of hemagglutinin and neuraminidase, the two proteins covering the surface of the virus. It's the macrophage that I'm talking about. To produce these molecules, the three predominant influenza strains are cultured in fertilized chicken eggs or, increasingly, in cell culture. Virus is then harvested and broken up so that the two proteins can be purified. And how well a given strain grows in either eggs or cells is hard to predict. However, and producing enough virus for millions of vaccine doses takes many months every year. This is a particular problem when a new pandemic influenza strain emerges. You just can't make enough vaccine and get it spread around. It has a shelf life. It has to be refrigerated. And you have to worry about molds and yeasts and all kinds of things that get into the manufacturing process. Most of the vaccine against that virus became available, against viruses becomes available well after the pandemic was past its peak. You just can't ramp up manufacturing that quick. Now, scientists at the Friedrich Löffler University Institute, Germany's Federal Research Institute for Animal Health, and biotech companies CureVac in Tübingen have developed a new approach. They designed a piece of the stem RNA, you know, this artificial RNA, it's called mRNA, encoding the hemagglutinin of the influenza strain H1N1, you're familiar with that. Cells use mRNA to shuttle the information contained in the genome from the nucleus into the periphery of the cell, where it is translated into a protein. By injecting synthetic mRNA into the skin of mice, the researchers coaxed the animal's cells into producing the virus protein themselves. This elicited an immune response that later protected the animals from infection with otherwise lethal doses of influenza virus. In other words, the antibody was made by the animal itself by using the synthetic mRNA. You don't actually inject the virus into the animal, only the stem protein. And so the animal develops an antibody against that. It doesn't matter what the influenza morphs into by random mutations. It means shots ready for distribution could be produced within 6 to 8 weeks, not 6 to 8 months. The vaccine does not need to be kept refrigerated for storage or distribution either, they claim, as it does away with the danger of an anaphylactic shock in people who are allergic to ovalbumin, a protein in the chicken eggs that is often present in the shots in very low amounts. Other researchers have tried using DNA rather than RNA to vaccinate against influenza, but while mouse experiments were promising, the results in human trials were disappointing. That the mRNA vaccine also shows an effect in ferrets and pigs makes it more likely that these results could hold true in humans as well. Well, that's because there are a lot of humans that are like ferrets, and definitely a lot of humans that are like pigs. Using RNA, which does its job outside the nucleus, is much simpler. But scientists long thought that RNA was too unstable to be used as a vaccine. CureVac, this commercial company, has overcome this problem by changing the sequence of the mRNA in a way that increases its stability up to 10,000-fold. That's where genetic modification comes in. The new vaccine would still have some of the drawbacks of the current vaccines. It only protects against a single influenza strain, in this case H1N1. It will get better. And because the flu virus changes its coats so rapidly, it would still have to be reformulated every year, like the current shots. The ideal for flu experts is the so-called universal vaccine that could confer immunity against a broad variety of flu strains. That's where they have to develop it against the stem of the protein. And we got a few more years before we figure that out. Now, also in pharmacology, I have a lot of friends that are drug salesmen. No, not that kind of drug salesman. I mean, like for Libby and Pfizer, you know, the legal drugs. One of the things that they have to learn before they go get their 90 seconds with the doctor, and that's about all they get when they sell the new drug, that's why they have to run commercials on TV. You know, the ones, right? Take this and, you know, when I'm talking about erections longer than 4 hours, blah, blah, blah. And don't forget about the side effects, blindness, thoughts of suicide, anal leakage, on and on and on. We always talk about drug-drug interaction as well. By the way, if you're taking beta blockers to control blood pressure, taking this might cause an unsafe drop in blood pressure, so please ask your doctor, blah, blah, blah. Drug-drug interaction. But have you ever heard of drug-food interaction? Oh, yeah. And it's a food you wouldn't think of. It is the innocuous, the absolutely unobtrusive, uninsulting, most least dangerous killer pink grapefruit. The number of drugs, when mixed with grapefruit juice, that can lead to serious health problems, including sudden death, has actually skyrocketed. It's true. I'm drinking pink grapefruit juice right now in front of you. Of course, I'm not doing any drugs. In an article in the Canadian, and that's a good way to say, I am drug-free, as you can see, I am drinking the dreaded pink grapefruit juice. In an article in the Canadian Medical Association Journal, David Bailey, a scientist at the Lawson Health Research Institute in London, Ontario, said more than 85 drugs, many of them highly prescribed for common medical conditions, are known to interact with the pink fruit. He made the link first 20 years ago. But the number of medications with the potential to interact with grapefruit and cause serious adverse health effects has jumped from 17 to 43 in the last 4 years as new drugs have been rolled out. How big of a problem are such interactions? Unless healthcare professionals are aware of the possibility that the adverse effect they are seeing might have an origin in the recent addition of grapefruit to the patient's diet, it is very unlikely that they will investigate it. Look, Mr. Jones, most of your problem would be solved if you would spend a little time on the elliptical machine each week and start drinking grapefruit juice, because it'll help you peel off some of that weight. But generally, patients don't say they eat grapefruit, and doctors don't ask. Grapefruit poses a risk when mixed with certain drugs because it inhibits an enzyme that metabolizes ingested drugs, resulting in the drugs entering the bloodstream at full force, which can lead to overdosing. You know what I'm talking about. You take two Advil, you take two ibuprofen, three will be okay, four, yeah, that'll get rid of it. The problem is that, you know, I weigh 275 pounds, I weigh 210 pounds. You know, these dosages are figured out, you know, based on pig research at 150 pounds. I weigh twice that, or I weigh, you know, 0.1 tons, which happens to be my weight. So I'm going to take a little bit more because my body weight dilutes it. Well, some of the drugs known to interact with grapefruit include anti-cancer agents, heart drugs, pain medications, and drugs to treat schizophrenia. All of them are administered orally. It doesn't take much grapefruit to have an effect. Drinking a single glass of grapefruit juice with medication can lead to serious side effects, including gastrointestinal bleeding, kidney failure, breathing problems, and, of course, the dreaded sudden death. Other citrus fruits, such as Seville oranges and limes, can have similar effects, but they have been studied less on account of people eat less of them. So if you're doing any of those drugs, be sure to ask your doctor if there is an interaction with the dreaded pink grapefruit juice. Earlier in tonight's program, and is the main reason why we do not have video tonight here at X Squared Radio, which is soon to be X Squared TV, Radio TV. That's one of the beauties of online and one of the magnificent beauties of BBS Radio, the finest radio our webcast radio network in the world. And by the way, that's documentable. You want to check it out? You can check it out yourself. And X Squared Radio is one of the top and sometimes the top program on the BBS radio network. We are going to pioneer with our good friends down in Paradise, California, which is not so paradise-like today because it's been raining heavily for several days because of the atmospheric river. What, pray tell, is the atmospheric river? Well, it's a long, narrow plume piping deep moisture from the tropics into the mid-latitudes. One type of atmospheric river, we also call it AR, you may have heard it as the Pineapple Express, goes from the Hawaiian Islands to the U.S. West Coast. Just pull up the Weather Channel and you can see it right there on the radar. Amazingly, according to NOAA's Earth System Research Laboratory, a strong AR can transport as water vapor up to 15 times the average flow of liquid water at the mouth of the Mississippi River. It's true. Suffice to say, if an AR stalls over a particular area, having the Mississippi River dumping in your backyard can produce flooding. That said, they're also important for Western water supply considerations. 30 to 50% of the average annual precipitation in the West Coast states typically occurs in just a few atmospheric river events. With that in mind, one such AR is poised right now to soak parts of the West Coast this week. And it's happening right now. This will send a parade of frontal systems and upper-level disturbances into the West Coast through this weekend and all next week. The soaking started Wednesday of this last week. While rain and high mountain snow forecast is primarily for California, also into western Oregon, parts of western Washington, I believe if the jet stream does what it's supposed to do, this could mean a lot of snow for the Wasatch Front as well. Then the atmospheric river makes landfall. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, today is Sunday. It will continue most of the week. Depending on where the moisture plume sets up, this heavy rain could produce significant impacts. You know, it's one of the four seasons in California. You have drought is one season. You have flood, mudslide is another season, and then there's, of course, the earthquake season, and that's basically the seasons that you get in California. Rainfall amounts in Southern California are expected to be much lighter, with totals over the next five-day period, about an inch or so. It's going to be a long, soaking rain. The winds are a little unpredictable, and at any given moment, there are billions of gallons suspended in the jet stream and various other tropospheric currents. When the dew point is reached, or when the moisture-laden air is pushed higher into sub-freezing air, snowflakes will form, high up, of course. When they get large enough, they begin to fall. When they fall through warm air, they turn to rain. That's the natural process, and that hasn't changed. What we are seeing is extreme arrangement of sky currents that may be responsible to a very large amplitude, low frequencies in which the Earth is traveling at this time. Now, we don't know whether these low frequency, high amplitude waves are coming from the galaxy, you know, because we're going through the galactic plane, or if they're coming from somewhere else. This time, as opposed to other times, for sure. That is to say, either the solar system is in a new neighborhood where these frequencies are located, or HARP is supplying those long-wave frequencies and causing these nodes to appear. What's a node? No, it's not like a lump on the side of your face. A node is when you tune a frequency to something that's the best match for a room or a specific area, say the distance around the Earth. You create a standing wave. If you look at a standing wave on an oscilloscope, you know exactly what I'm looking about. I'm talking about. If you don't tune it just right, it just looks like a wide band of light across the phosphorus screen. But if you tune it to exactly the right triggering frequency, the wave will stop on the screen, and you can measure its voltage and its frequency and all of that. Well, the high point and the low points, that's what I'm talking about, are nodes, the mountains and the valley, I guess, of the wave. When you follow that wave to the top, that's the node. That's where all the high points match up and make a huddle of energy. And that's why large amounts of energy, known as a stream or river, end up forming. A sky river forms just like a land river. It's the point of least resistance where large amounts of energy can become organized. You know, like the low place in the land is where the river goes, and eventually it carves the Grand Canyon over 65 million years, blah, blah, blah. Same thing happens in the sky. The question on everyone's mind is HARP capable of scattering these atmospheric rivers, or is it responsible for forming the atmospheric rivers? That's a question we do not have time to answer tonight, but we will definitely cover it over the coming weeks. Very quick GMO update, very quick. The European Union's Food Safety Agency definitively rejected Wednesday a bombshell French report linking genetically modified corn to cancer, saying it failed to meet acceptable scientific standards, whatever the heck that means. Harvested cobs of corn dry on the ground outside a house near Gaomi in eastern China's Shandong province. A French study published earlier this year said rats fed on NK603 corn developed tumors. The EU's Food Safety Agency rejected that. Serious defects in the design and methodology of a paper by Seralani et al. Means it does not meet acceptable scientific standards, the European Food Safety Authority said in a statement. I read the report. I thought it was very thorough. EFSA, which reviews the use and authorization of GMOs, added that it finds there's no need to re-examine its previous safety evaluations of NK603, the genetically modified maize developed by U.S. agribusiness giant Monsanto. That same conclusion had been reached in separate and independent assessments of Gilles Eric Seralani's work carried out in six European Union nations, the agency added. Seralani's research team at France's University of Caen used a report in September concluding that rats fed on NK603 corn or exposed to one of Monsanto's weed killers used with the corn strain and contained glyphosate developed tumors. Study's conclusions, illustrated by horrific images of cancer-ridden rats, caused worldwide alarm. But many experts quickly questioned its methodology, results, and relevance to humans. The EU said, just because a bunch of rats get tumors doesn't mean humans will. It listed weaknesses of the French study as unclear study objectives, the low number of rates used in each treatment group, a lack of detail on the feed and treatment formulation, key information missing on the statistical methods employed. But the scientist responded that he would not give EFSA additional information until it first detailed the basis of its own assessment. It is absolutely scandalous that EFSA keeps secret the information on which they base their evaluation of NK603 and the pesticide. In any event, we will not give them anything. We will put the information in the public domain when they do. His research group, spelled Cregan, this month issued a list of almost 200 scientists from more than 30 countries who back the study that say the NK603 does cause cancer in rats. So much going on. I only made it about two-thirds of the way through what I wanted to cover tonight. Usually I can get through a lot more pages than this, but the plethora of phone calls delayed us. Yeah, maybe you didn't call. I read for 3 hours all my notes and put this together. I have 37 pages. Anybody interested in getting a copy of all of my program notes tonight, you can write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com, bagnew@x2-radio.com. I'll be happy to send it to you in Word format, and you can read all this stuff for yourself. Great, great stuff. I got stuff on the exobiology of the human genome, and it's an extensive paper, which is really tremendous. It shows that human and chimp DNA is very close to one another, but it cannot account for the jump in consciousness for the human being. something else involved there, and you can see the splice in the drawings, and it's quite fantastic. And we finish out the evening with a Gnostic theory of alien intrusion. This is by John Lash, Phenomenon Magazine, if you want to look it up. It is really a tremendous thing. Goes all the way back to the Nag Hammadi. Physical description of archons occur in several Gnostic codices. It's quite a neat little article. I'm out of time. We're going to have to go and let my folks at Asheville Magazine say goodnight to you. Please show up next week right here on X Squared Radio. I've got a lot more stuff to go over next week. Next week we should have X Squared Radio TV live, so you'll be able to see what's going on. I can hold up this stuff and show it to you. We're going to introduce a new age of webcast radio because it's going to be interactive. Whatever, if you see something going on out there, you can stream it to us from your phone and we can put it on the air live and people can see it all over the world. If you've got something you want to show, it's live, or you've made a recording or an image somewhere, you can send it to us. There is not another radio program anywhere on earth capable of doing this. But we here at BBS Radio can do it. We can deliver it, and we can make it really entertaining for everybody and really informative. So be sure to tune in next week right here on X Squared Radio. We'll see you.